Introduce our main speaker for this evening, Twain from San Diego.
Yeah, maybe a little. Thanks. Appreciate that. Yeah, thanks a lot. Good evening, everybody. I'm Twain, and I am an alcoholic. And for those of you who will listen to this on CD, there's about 1,500 people here. Yeah. I live here in San Diego. I'm from Louisiana. Lived there most of my life. And there's a laid-back, laissez-faire, slow as molasses lifestyle. And with that comes fewer restraints. And in the sweltering heat and humidity and sweat, beer and gin taste really good. Yeah. And my parents, great parents, I love them dearly. My dear mother passed away 12 years ago. I had a great relationship with her, thanks to AA. My father, he's 92, still alive in Shreveport, and I go back to see him frequently. I have a great relationship with him, thanks to AA. And they did the very best job they could as parents for where they were at. But my earliest memories from childhood were that there was very little affection, very little communication, very little contact, actually, in my childhood years. And I remember when I was, my earliest memories, I felt alone. I felt like I didn't belong. I felt like I was different. And I had a lot of fear. In growing up, my mother was a lady of Shreveport society, a really good woman. But in that time, a lot of mothers like her spent very little time, with the kids. That was left for the help. And I really didn't, I don't remember any affection or contact or communication with her in those early years. And my father was a hardworking lawyer, and we didn't see much of him either. When he came home from work, after working a hard day, she would take him by the hand, and they would go trotting out to go to parties. And I remember we had this lovely lady named Yolanda is the way we said it. Was a really sweet mulatto woman from Natchitoches, along Cane River. Really good woman. But at night, and she would babysit us. At night, she would talk about voodoo with us. and to put me to bed, she would talk to me about the boogeyman. And so I would stay up with the lights on, try not to go to sleep, because she told me the boogeyman will come and get you when you fall asleep. So that might have had some effect on me. And the teachers at school would contact my parents and bring to their attention that that at school I was sullen and I was always by myself, and they were really worried about me. And I remember my father, I overheard my father saying, what's wrong with that boy? And I don't know if I was born an alcoholic. I think I probably was, but I don't know that for sure. But I do know that I thought that I was born weird. And but things got a whole lot better for me. My life turned around. At age 13, a neighborhood kid got hold of some Bacardi rum and some lemon lime ices. And that went down real warm, tasted great, and I was Superboy. I belonged. That changed my life for the better. King alcohol was good to me for a long, long, long time. And another good thing about King alcohol was, around drinking, I started getting loving acts of tenderness from my mom and also from my dad. And I remember, like, it coming home. Let me backtrack for a second. I started drinking at 13, and then immediately we were able to get our liquor at the Liquor to Go. And we, at 15, we were driving age. We had our fake IDs, and we could go to bars and drink freely without constraint. And I remember coming home from the bar. You could stop off at the daiquiri to go. And, you know, back then in Louisiana, they didn't even require you to put that little bitty piece of paper on the tip of the straw, you know, taped on the tip of the straw. They didn't even require that back then. So it's a different life there. And but a loving act of kindness was, like, I would drink and stay out till the very wee hours, and I'd come home, and there'd be a waiting for me on the kitchen table, a little paper napkin and two aspirin and a glass of water. And that was so sweet of my mom. I just, you know, I was really touched by it. And then in the morning, I remember one time having a really, really bad night, and I was a really bad hangover, and my dad referred to it as, that I looked like the hare who bit the dog. And, one of those mornings, my mom, made me a Bloody Mary. And she would say, well, Bubby, how do you feel? You know? And it was very loving. I was very touched. I was very touched by that. You know? And anyway, in high school, we drank all the time. We drank everywhere. We had dances, Saturday night dances that we went to. There would be a chaperone, but the chaperone wasn't paying any mind. You know? We just drank, and they would last till 1 a.m. in the morning, and I'd get drunker than Cooter Brown. And I started not remembering, the ride homes. The blackouts had already begun. The blackouts had already begun. So it came time for college, and no-brainer. LSU Baton Rouge, voted by Playboy magazine the greatest party school in the nation. You know? And it was a blast. LSU Baton Rouge. The keg parties, happy hours every night except for Sunday. And Friday night happy hour, Friday happy hours actually started at 1 p.m. in the afternoon. 25-cent bourbon and cokes served at the Brass Rail. You know, it was hard, and I was studious. I was academic. I wanted to study and make good grades. It was very difficult, challenging to find a time slot, you know, to do any studying. New Orleans, 1 hour away. So when I remember the LSU football games, we would start tipping in the early morning, and by kickoff at 8 p.m., most of us would be passed out. It was rampant. And so went on to law school. In law school, the blackouts became more frequent. More often, I was waking up in a stranger's bed, not knowing where my car was. And I remember one thing that really stands out there during those early years. Then I returned to Shreveport to practice my profession, And finally, my luck ran out with the DUIs. I finally was actually arrested for DUI instead of being let go. And I was actually taken down to the Paris jail by an inexperienced officer. And and I was put in a jail cell there in the Paris jail, the same jail where I frequented during the day representing those criminals. And there I was. There I was. I felt uncomfortable. But a really loving act of kindness from my father came about from that. I was bailed out by my dad. He came down there in his raincoat and got me out. And on the ride home, he was very consoling to his son, Bubba. And he said, "Well, how in the hell do they expect us to go out drinking and return home if we can't drink and drive?" Yeah. Yeah. And the BAC level, 0.2, you can't get drunk at the BAC level, 0.1, you can't get drunk at 0.1. Hell, they need to raise it to 0.2. And he goes, "I'm sorry, Bubba, this happened to you. It shouldn't have happened." Yeah. He was a very good lawyer, and the next day he started preparing my defense. He got hold of the police reports. Of course, the police report said the usual jargon that I was weaving and that I wasn't making sense. And his response to that was, "Well, hell, boy, you always drive like that. You always act like that." Yeah. So his strategy was to call several witnesses to testify under oath that was true. You know. But anyway, this is one of the very best memories I have of my dad. You know? He was very loving, and he put his heart and soul into it. The charge was dismissed. He was a very skilled lawyer. And, you know, but that was real, real dear to me, real dear to me. You know, my years as a lawyer, you know, I'm not going to go through it step by step. I drank and I smoked dope and I snorted and the blackouts just got more and more often. At age 32, I landed a good job here in San Diego. And I was very excited about that. I was finally getting my butt out of Northwest Louisiana, where I felt constrained there. I felt confined. I had never been anywhere but Louisiana, so I was really looking forward to getting out of there. But not before I was on the receiving end of some shame from my dad. And I remember I went into his office to tell him, and he was very serious, and he looked at me and said, "Boy, you going out west too like your sister Jo? Have you gone gay too?" Yeah. Anyway, I was able to pull from my sugar dad's strings and came out here to San Diego. And the first few months, I was ecstatic. I was painting the town. But then it started to fade on me. First was the weather. You know, there's no weather out here. Yeah. And I know I should have known that or did know that before I came out here, but it nevertheless it started affecting me. But another thing was the rules, the regulations and the standards out here. I remember my first venture out of my apartment to go jogging. I put on my tennies and I was starting to jog down the alleyway, and some onlooker stopped me and said I wasn't wearing the right pair of running shoes. And then he went on to tell me that I wasn't using the proper running technique. So, you know. And then I returned to my apartment with my tail wagging between my legs. And then I remember another occasion I decided to make my first outing out to the beach. Well, I'd go out to the beach, and there'd be this tall sign of commandments, you know, that I had never seen before at any beach, you know, in anywhere in the Deep South. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this, you can't do that. I was just overwhelmed by it. And it was, and then, you know, this talk about you can have an, you can't have an open container. Well, what the hell does that mean? That means it's okay to have a closed container. And then, but then if, why would anybody bring a closed container out there to the beach? And then I was actually talking this over with somebody this morning. We were researching on the internet. I guess if there's a closed container, you can possibly put a little hole in there and suck the booze out. I'm not sure. I'm not sure, but it didn't make any sense to me. And then another day, I ventured out past the wave swimming, and then I overheard on a loudspeaker a commandment, which I found out was from a lifeguard, ordering me to come back to the shore now. You know, I came back to the shore and I never figured out why. You know, and then going to Jack Murphy Baseball Stadium, the security guards. In Louisiana, I had never seen a security guard other than at the bank. You know, I mean, and then, but at Jack Murphy Stadium, there'd be like, in the number of security guards dressed in those uniforms, all lined up. I don't know how many there were. It seemed like there were about 100 of them. And it felt like the Gestapo. Yeah. And then at work, I remember my first week at work, I was walking towards the courthouse and across the street, and a police officer stopped me. And I asked him, and he told me that I was jaywalking. Well, anyway, I started laughing because I told him that the only time I'd ever heard of anybody being stopped for jaywalking was by Barney Fife on the Andy Griffith Show. You know? And he wrote me up a citation. And then, you know, actually being in the courtroom, I was doing a jury trial in the courtroom, and there was Judge Finley. Apparently she didn't take too kindly to people from the South, because she actually put on the record and ordered that I not use the word y'all. Yeah. It took me off my game. I didn't know how to do it. How do you question witnesses without saying y'all? You people? You guys? It just doesn't sound right. It sounds impersonal. So I was having difficulty being here in San Diego. And another thing was, you know, I didn't know in the morning whether I should put on my new suit that I bought here in San Diego or whether I should put on my seersucker. Because, you know, it just depended on, you know, some of the people at the office took kindly to people from the South, and they wanted me to be a Southern, a Southern cracker. But others didn't, you know. So I had a real problem with identity. You know, I didn't know whether to be somebody from San Diego. I didn't know whether to be a Southern cracker. And if I was going to be a Southern cracker, should I talk? Should I be real witty and literate? You know, like Mark Twain. Some of them kind of were expecting that out of me. So I was out of place. I had no identity, and I was, you know, I was in a tizzy. And I remember one time at a staff meeting, I was like chewing on my ink pen, and ink got all over my lapel, you know. So, you know, it was challenging. But the thing about what was my identity is something I actually had grappled with since I was a little boy. So I started drinking and tooting and snorting more and more. And the more I did it, the gloomier I got, the lonelier I got, and the stupider I got. King alcohol was no longer my friend, was no longer benefiting me. I remember on a weekend afternoon in my apartment, you know, smoking dope and, you know, drinking scotch. And I did not have the mental capacity to even watch my favorite TV show, The Three Stooges. All I could muster was to smoke my Marlboro Reds, drink my scotch, sit in my chair and listen to Neil Young. That's all I could do. I was really, it was becoming pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. It got worse and worse, and I ended up, things got so bad that I ended up at the Mesa Vista loony bin. And I remember there I was, we were required to paint little yellow ceramic duckies, and I have no skills with my hands. I have no handicraft skills. And we were also told to make a moccasin belt out of leather. And I cannot describe to you the anguish I felt trying to do those things. Well, I was there about 2 weeks, and when I left there, returned to my apartment, I stopped off at the liquor store, and I started about a 5-day binge. You know, I tried to I put up the blankets on the windows, and I took my phone off the hook, and I tried to stay unconscious all through the day, you know, on booze. But as you know, it's impossible to remain unconscious. And it's impossible to keep some light from seeping through when the sun comes up. And I remember the moaning doves. You know, I felt horror when I heard the moaning doves. Moaning doves. We didn't have moaning doves in Louisiana. And I lived in PB. And to this day, I get uncomfortable in the morning when I hear, ooh, ooh, ooh. Yeah. I know it sounds kind of like an owl, but I came out of that binge, and then my boozer stoner friend came over, and I forgot to say I had to take a leave of absence from work. And my boozer stoner friend came over, and he did a one-on-one intervention on me, telling me I needed to go to AA meetings all day long, every day. But I also had something else in mind. I was on a mission to become certified as a bilingual attorney, so I had booked a trip to Mexico to attend one of those academies, and then I also wanted to do extra traveling in addition to that, so I was, you know, wanting to go to Mexico for 5 months. And I there was a travel an agent who actually booked the trip and arranged everything. So, but I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that I needed to be going to AA meetings, but you know, I wanted to go to Mexico. You know, so I booked the trip. I canceled the trip. I booked the trip. I canceled the trip. Taking a trip, not taking a trip. You know, to this day, that's one of my very favorite sayings in the Big Book, and I had it as a bumper sticker for a long time. You know? So I arrived in San Miguel de Allende, and all my luggage was stolen. My Spanish sucked. I tried to talk to the Mexican police about reporting my luggage, and they laughed. I went to the nearest Mexican bar I could find and commenced a 5-day binge. And but I crawled out of that. I crawled out of that binge, and was able to go to the pharmacy and put together the right, pharmaceuticals and liquor, and I went on a wild and crazy run. It was the last good experience I had with King alcohol. You know, I came back to San Diego, and things got worse and worse. And Bill Wilson describes those last weeks better than I can describe them. He says, "The chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. The awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. I'm sitting at the Stagecoach bar, and I remember Guns N' Roses playing on the karaoke, and I found myself scooting away the beer. I knew I was at the crossroads, either the road to blackness or the road to, through AA. And I knew, and I felt a sense of surrender. I felt the presence of God. And I knew I was never, ever going to drink again. That was January 26, 1992. From there, the miracle continued. The next night, I went to a drumming party, which was attended by some AA people, and I overheard somebody say, do I know you? I've heard that voice before. And it turned out he knew my brother John, who had been with me at an earlier time here in San Diego. And John was the one who first introduced me to AA. John was... I loved dearly, and John was the first one who had taken me to some AA meetings. And my sponsor, David became my sponsor, and then later on that night we went and had coffee with a dear friend of his, Michael. And that was the beginning of the AA fellowship for me. It was like the triangle of myself, David, and Michael, and that was the beginning of the fellowship for me. And when I set my mind to something, I am serious about it. I did the AA steps to the very best of my ability that first year. I did them thoroughly, but my early sobriety was rocky, to say the least. I still had feelings of not belonging, and I remember a few months into it, I was at the spring roundup, and I was about to get out of my car, and I had one foot out, but then I put it back in the car. Then I put my foot out, then I put it back in the car. I was debating on whether or not I really wanted to go, and I think I was at a turning point. Well, anyway, thank goodness, through the grace of God, I got out, and I walked into the spring roundup, and the fellowship there and the spiritual breakfast was a real, real turning point for me. Another challenge I had in early sobriety was I was still crazy as a loon. I was very indecisive. Like, I remember on Sunday afternoons, when there would be a lull in what to do, and like, for instance, no AA meetings or in the afternoon, Sunday afternoon, you don't go to work, you've already gone to church. So I'd be in my apartment going back crazy. Should I go visit Linda? Should I go visit Steve? Should I go to the beach? Should I go to the movie? Should I go to the adult bookstore? And then, so I called David, just crazy as could be, and he said, just pick one. It doesn't matter. Just pick one. And know that you're going to change your mind, a million times. But it doesn't matter. Just pick one and stick with it. He was a great sponsor. He continues to be a great sponsor. There are other instances of challenges which I went through. But generally, the next 22 years or so was on an upward trajectory. There were some ups and downs, but generally it was on an upward trajectory. I did learn that you should heed Bill Wilson's advice and not only pray for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. Don't put specifics in your prayer. And I learned that the hard way. I prayed for that I be married and have kids. But in that prayer, I didn't include the specifics about not going through a $70,000 divorce custody battle. You know, so I still had some challenges. I'm really grateful that I was invited to speak here tonight. And I want to welcome the newcomers. I need to tell you that I. In addition to being an alcoholic, I also suffer a mental disorder. I suffer from depression, and I've gone. Many of my adult years have been on psychotropic meds to help me with it. And I there was a 2.5-year period in my recent past where things got bad for me again. It was a dark period for me, and the. I don't know whether the depression preceded or whether my lack of involvement with AA preceded. I don't know, and I don't think it really matters. But the fact of the matter is, AA also lost its priority for me, and some bad things happened in my personal life, and I ended up going through a really dark period that lasted about 2.5 years. And this period did not end until this past August. And in August, it started going back up into an upward trajectory. And I'm doing a lot better now. The promises are starting to come true again. I'm still not on top of my game. I don't have my edge. I don't have my funny bone. But life is getting better, and the promises are coming true for me again. And I pat myself on the back. I never drank. And I thank God for God's grace. During that period, during my lowest hour, I prayed. I got on my knees and prayed for the umpteenth time, God help me, God help me. And I couldn't feel anything. I couldn't feel God. And I was disconnected, but I would just say it over and over again. And gradually things did get better again for me through my psychiatrist, but also I just amped up my AA. Went to more meetings, more active in service, more active in sponsorship, in every way possible. I prayed more. I had more gratitude. I'd really, really worked hard, and I was able to climb out of that. And I'm doing a lot better now. But what I've learned from that experience is that we don't know sometimes what God has in store for us. Maybe my ego needed smashing because out of that came some very positive experiences. The type of work I'm now doing is very fulfilling, and it's a direct result of my having gone through that that dark experience. But another thing that I've really come to realize is that for me, for this alcoholic, I have to put AA first. And got to put AA first, and don't drink no matter what. Even if your butt is on fire, don't drink. And put AA first, put God first, and life will get better. The promises do come true. And I love AA. AA has saved my life. I love the fellowship of AA. And I'm just eternally grateful. And I want to just end by saying my message is simple. Don't drink no matter what. Put AA first. And the promises do come true. The promises come true. And life does get better. God bless us all. God bless AA. Thank you.